You would be forgiven for thinking that everybody out there today falls into one of two categories. People who never leave their home and just sit around playing video games all day, and people who are putting in 60-hour weeks while simultaneously working their daily MySpace microvlog featuring their cryptocurrency dropshipping automation course for course makers that they do in their spare time between cold plunges and flipping labubos. But it's not just you seeing things. People really are starting businesses at record numbers while at the same time giving up the job market altogether. So the question is, have we entered a golden age of hustle, or have people run out of other options? The data is probably not what you think, and it tells us a lot about overworking, underemployment, and the strange gaps emerging in a job market that really doesn't want that many people anymore.
Everyone would like to have a little extra cash in their pocket, and 44 million Americans are actually being proactive about it. According to a new survey, that's the number of people in the U.S. with a side gig or a side hustle.
Working 55 or more hours a week is associated with a 35% higher risk of a stroke and a 17% higher risk of dying from heart disease.
We're working 40, 50 hours in the office and another 20, 30 hours outside of the office, networking, meeting, Skyping, bringing our computers home.
So new businesses being formed is normally a really good sign that the economy is doing well. People normally only start a new business when they feel confident about their future and the future of the market they want to operate in. If you thought a recession was all but guaranteed and you weren't sure how you were going to pay your bills next month, you probably wouldn't be starting a business. Launch of new business creation is also a sign that people have achieved a certain level of financial security. Starting a new business often means making some significant upfront investments into renting some commercial space, buying equipment, purchasing inventory, and for a lot of businesses, hiring some staff. Most new business owners should also expect to go for some time without taking any income while their business builds up sustainable cash flows. This means if lots of people are starting businesses, lots of people are in a comfortable enough financial position to bear these costs. Lots of new businesses is also more than a sign that things are going well. They actually make things go well. New businesses create employment for people who just want a job, and they improve productivity in a few ways. Business owners, especially new business owners on average, will put in more time and effort working for themselves than they would in a regular day job. This means they're making more output than they would be if they were just working a 9-to-5. New businesses can also become successful businesses that bring valuable products or services to market. If you start a business-to-business company that develops a new type of software that streamlines AI-generated LinkedIn appreciation posts, then you could save millions of wasted man-hours across the country, which means workers could actually do something better and more productive with their time. Likewise, if you start a business selling a consumer product, it could add competition to the market for similar products, or if you develop a new product altogether, it could make people happier, healthier, smarter, or just keep them entertained. Of course, most new businesses fail. But for society at large, the few that succeed are usually a good thing. So then why is this record level of business creation in America not exactly great news? Well, there are actually three reasons. The first is simply why these businesses are being started. A 2023 paper by Ryan Decker of the Federal Reserve Board and John Haltewanger of the University of Maryland found some interesting patterns with these new businesses. The first was that these new businesses were largely being formed in states and counties with lower average incomes. Now, most counties saw an increase overall, but the outskirts of cities, particularly hard-hit states, outpaced the rest by a significant margin. The authors of this paper suggested that a lot of this business formation was just existing businesses closing in city centers that didn't see much foot traffic and reopening in suburbs where the rent is lower and they can cater to a market of people working remotely. This wouldn't actually really increase business activity because it's just moving it around from one place to another. But closed businesses can stay registered for a long time after they physically shut down. Now, this move to the burbs might not actually be doing any good, but it's not doing any harm either. Unfortunately, it doesn't account for the entirety of this trend. And a lot of the other people starting a new business aren't doing it to follow their dreams. They are doing it because they have no other option. And it's probably making things much worse than we realize. So it's time to learn how money works to find out how a record number of businesses might be quietly breaking the economy. This video is sponsored by Taylor Brands. If you're actually interested in running a serious company and starting a real business, you're going to need to have your paperwork sorted correctly. That's where Taylor Brands comes in. They're a business builder that not only helps you form your LLC, but also gives you everything you need to actually grow your business. When you sign up, you get way more than just paperwork. You'll find tools like a personalized business plan, coaching programs, legal documents, even invoices and bookkeeping. It's like having your own business toolkit ready to go. I found it makes the whole process less intimidating. Instead of piecing things together from a dozen places, I can just log in, see exactly what I need to do next, and know I'm setting myself up the right way. Tailored Brands really gives you the confidence to focus on your goals while they handle the structure behind the scenes. If you're ready to take the next step for your business, head to the link in the description or pinned comment to get started with Tailored Brands today. So actually figuring out how our economy is going is something that our governments really struggle with. Collecting data on hundreds of millions of people, millions of businesses, and billions of transactions is actually really hard. So they often make some calculated guesses based on historic patterns. As impractical as it would be for the Bureau of Labor Statistics to scrape every job posting off Indeed and look through every classified section to find new jobs being created, it wouldn't even be that accurate. The rise of ghost job listings means that there are almost twice as many job postings as there were 5 years ago. But as anybody who has tried to get a job in the last 24 months will tell you, businesses aren't exactly in a rush to hire. That's a problem, because government agencies use job creation data to make very important budget and interest rate decisions, so we really shouldn't be making shit up. One of the other historical assumptions has been more business creation equals more job creation. Businesses need employees, so this makes sense. Except the data has actually started saying the opposite. In the report on the rise in new business applications, Decker and Haltewanger found that counties with a higher rate of business creation were actually correlated with a higher rate of job destruction. This data really just confirmed what a lot of people already suspected. People weren't starting businesses to take advantage of some amazing opportunity. They were starting them because they had no other choice. According to a broad market survey, 36% of the American workforce is now engaged in the gig economy. Some of these people are doing this in conjunction with their regular day job as a way to earn extra money. But whatever the exact details, that is still a significant increase from just 5 years ago. Gig workers are encouraged to register a business and keep track of their revenue and expenses just like any other business. But unlike other business, none of these people are going to be hiring employees or investing a lot of money into the broader economy. In the past, people starting a new business usually had a bit of experience in their field and a bit of cash in their pocket to get their business set up. At the very least, they had some investors that were willing to trust them with upfront capital to get their idea off the ground. Most of these new gig economy businesses today are started by people without enough experience to land a job and without any cash at all. Now, it's not all bad. For a lot of people, being able to sign up instantly to perform work in the gig economy instead of going through the outdated hurdles of job interviews is a big reason why these platforms have become so popular. But these jobs also shouldn't be sugarcoated. They are insecure, don't pay well, and are quite dangerous. This technology is truly unprecedented, and in the short term it has existed, it's already reshaped what we think of as work. It's really up to you if it's been for better or worse, though. So you might think this is just another example of a slow government struggling to keep up with changes in technology that have redefined the labor force. But there are two reasons why government agencies have tried really hard to intentionally ignore this trend. The first reason is that headlines about job creation and business development are great for re-election. Nobody wants to be in charge when the data collectors change their methodology and reveal that millions of jobs we thought exist actually don't. The second reason is that it makes it look like big programs are actually working. Late last year, the Small Business Administration made a press release bragging about the success of a business loan program made to minorities. In it, they highlighted how previously underrepresented groups had been starting a record number of businesses. Now, before a whole big thing starts in the comments, yes, these loans probably should have been made based on socioeconomic need, but statistically, they show the same thing anyway. The Small Business Administration thought they had successfully empowered a new group of business owners. What they had actually done was just record these groups registering for Uber Eats. Even highly skilled workers with a lot of experience have not been immune from this trend either. The number of people working as independent contractors jumped significantly as businesses moved away from full-time hires and the worker protections that came with it. Typically, independent contractors should have the freedom to work when and where they want as long as they deliver the agreed-upon product or service within the agreed-upon timeframe. But a lot of businesses have not so subtly mandated that their contractors be in office just like any normal employee, just without the security or benefits. A study by the National Employment Law Project found that a lot of these independent contractors were forced to sign non-compete agreements as part of their contract. This meant they had all the independence of an employee combined with all the safety of someone in business for themselves. Now, for certain people, especially those at the top of their field, being an independent contractor is a great opportunity to provide services to multiple different companies and charge a much higher hourly rate than 9-to-5 employees ever could. These kinds of private contractors didn't suddenly become twice as common, though. Most of this growth is simply explained by people working full-time jobs with contractor conditions. It also means that job opportunities aren't as plentiful as the numbers would suggest, because even if lots of new jobs have actually been created, they are likely being worked by someone who already had a job and just needed a second or third source of income to keep up with living expenses. Now, I know for a lot of you watching, you already know this, but ignoring this issue will probably end up making it worse. These charts aren't just here for me to make depressing videos every week. They should inform policy. If we can't even acknowledge a problem, it makes it much harder to fix. Over just the last 6 months, the job market has changed dramatically. Again. Back in the good old days of 2024, all workers had to worry about was ghost jobs, quiet firing, job washing, career cushioning, invisible overtime, application black holes, recenteeism, digital downsizing, compensation compression, burnout attrition, and when all else fails, good old fashioned rolling layoffs. But today, the job market is dealing with a whole new set of trends. And don't worry, they come with a whole fresh list of dumb corporate buzzwords. New economic data, if we are allowed to believe that anymore, is revealing some stark realities about the ways that people are finding a job, keeping a job, and progressing in a job. Unfortunately, as you have probably already guessed, a lot of these changes are throwing young workers, and in particular young men, out of the frying pan and into the fire. For the first time ever, unemployment amongst young male college graduates is the same as non-graduates. The share of unemployed people entering the job market for the first time is the highest it has been since 1988. And job mobility has effectively frozen. Now, I know what you might be thinking. All things considered, the unemployment rate still looks pretty good, right? Well, that might actually be part of the problem. And if all of this wasn't bad enough already, there is now a good chance that art history majors are earning more than you are.
So ever since you found out about AI, you've learned that your computer science degree is actually a complete joke.
New college graduates are facing one of the most challenging markets for entry-level jobs in a decade.
It's just like getting the first job that's so hard. I've tried to apply for jobs for like a year now, and just like most places like don't get back to me, or they just like say no.
I make fun of my college degree all the time because I'm not self-conscious, realize it wasn't worth it, even though society deems it as a great accomplishment.
I'm about to call my school up and say that this degree that I spent 4 years trying to get, 4 years, was a waste of money.
There is a funny but not totally inaccurate anecdote amongst business analysts that if you want to find an industry that's about to have really bad job security, then just look where all the Ivy League grads are going. For a while, that was oil and gas companies before the 1980s oil crisis. Then it was outsourcing operations before the Asian financial crisis, then early technology before the dot-com crash, finance before the global financial crisis, and now, over the most recent decade, it's been big tech paying huge salaries to talented graduates early in their careers. Now, obviously, there is a lot of hindsight here. Nothing can boom forever. And of course, a lot of young graduates from top schools are going to try to find a job that pays them as well as possible, if for no other reason than to start paying back that tuition. The problem is that everybody else sees these growing industries where people can make good money earlier in their career, and they try to get qualifications to move into those roles too. But no industry can boom forever, and by the time most people catch up, they find themselves overqualified for a role that doesn't exist anymore. For the last 10 years, the story has been that everybody getting laid off from their factory job should just learn to code. But before that, it was everybody should go and get an MBA. According to the Graduate Management Admissions Council, 2022, right after the dot-com crash, was the all-time peak of people enrolling in postgraduate business school in the hopes that it would boost their stalling careers. According to the numbers today, it looks like that well-intentioned but ultimately flawed advice may be going to college at all, as the unemployment rate is now the same between graduates and non-graduates. After this data went live, there were several articles concluding that this signifies the end of the higher education payoff, which is probably a bit of an oversimplification for the sake of hyperbole. This is absolutely a concerning trend, but there are two important details you need to understand about it before you go canceling that college admission. The first is that if both of these groups have the same rate of unemployment, that doesn't necessarily mean that the earnings advantage of college is gone. Looking for a job as a qualified engineer is normally going to be better than looking for a job as an unskilled laborer, so even though the same share of these two groups may be out of work, the earnings of the college graduates is still higher. Also, something I feel I need to repeat as often as I can, the unemployment rate is a really narrow statistic that people pay far too much attention to as a singular data point. To count as unemployed, you need to be out of the job and actively looking for more work. Today, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, about 72% of people with a bachelor's degree or higher qualification are actively working or looking for a job. That number is falling every year, which we will address soon. but it's still significantly higher than the 56% of high school graduates who are actively engaged in the labor force, and it's even worse for people who didn't graduate high school, but they are getting more involved. And again, we will get to why soon. For now, what you need to remember is that even though this particular statistic looks bad, and don't get me wrong, it is bad, you are still more likely to have a job and have a higher paying job with a college degree. But that's still not the whole calculation. Degrees are not free, and a lot of people are realizing that lifetime earnings are great and all, but sometimes a little bit of money early in life with no debt is better than more money later in life with big repayments the moment you are handed a piece of paper. The trend is that every year, the math is looking a little bit worse, and that is something that should be carefully considered for any investment with a 40 or 50 year payoff period. But that's just the statistical details that you need to understand about this graduate unemployment problem. The second and much more important point is that this only applies to men. The unemployment gap for graduate women is lower than it has been historically, but is still pretty wide, and it's actually been growing at the same time the gap for men has been disappearing. And the question is, why? Well, this strange difference actually reveals a lot about other recent trends in the job market. Another subtle but extremely important change that has been recorded in the job market is the changing payoff for job hopping. We've mentioned multiple times that workers who are overly loyal to their company statistically earn significantly less over their working careers when compared to those who hop jobs for promotions or pay bumps. But that has changed, and over the last year, the benefit has all but disappeared. Now, a little bit of that is because wage growth is just slowing down overall. But a larger trend is that the job market is encouraging staying put and doing absolutely nothing. Nobody is hiring, nobody is leaving their job, nobody is pushing for a promotion, and nobody is doing anything that could open them up to the next round of layoffs. According to industry reports, some people are even avoiding new jobs that could be considered career advancements so they can stay with a company in a role where they are past probation and feel less at risk of being let go. This is also benefiting people in less boom and bust careers like those who went and got an arts degree. Generally, these people go into their fields because they are genuinely passionate about it over people who are chasing a lucrative career. They generally take less career risks and hold on to roles that they become extremely proficient at, which makes them harder to replace than random business and commerce graduate number A3113. This is not the best strategy in good times if all you care about was making money, but it gave them a head start on what everybody is doing right now, which is holding on to their job for dear life. This trend of people holding on to their roles has its own buzzword, because of course it has its own buzzword, and it's called job hugging. Overall, it's not a great sign when combined with the less than stellar new jobs data, but it is the logical response by all parties dealing with increased uncertainty, which is where we get back to this growing gap between young men and women in the workplace. There is a lot to unpack there, but there are three key differences driving this trend. The first is the push to equalize gender balance in certain roles, but not all roles. The push has been toward getting women into male-dominated fields that require a college degree like STEM and business management, but not as much the unskilled fields that are also dominated by men like the trades and labor roles. Women in STEM has been a big focus of government programs, corporate initiatives, and school enrollments for decades at this point, and it's been highly successful at opening up the field to more talent. This means that men are competing with a wider base of competition than they would have in the past, and the simple fact is that there are only so many of these jobs to go around. But at the same time, the men in roles that don't require a college degree haven't had the same increase in competition. This isn't a new trend. Before the pandemic shook up a lot of this data, male college grads had an unemployment rate of around 5%, while their non-graduate peers had an unemployment rate of 6%. Female college graduates at the same time had an unemployment rate of around 3%, but their non-graduate peers also had 6% unemployment, so the gap was much wider. Now, it's important to point out that there have been similar programs to try to get men into historically women-dominated graduate fields too, especially nursing, aged care, and elementary school teaching. But overall, they have been less successful. Now, there are a few reasons for this. If we are being completely honest with one another, there is still a stigma around this. A woman landing a role as an engineer or office executive is seen as empowerment, where a guy becoming a nurse is still the butt of the joke, and an elementary school teacher is the target of suspicion and raised eyebrows. It absolutely should not be like this, and it is getting better, but it's silly to pretend it doesn't exist. The second reason is that historically, these roles have not paid as well, and men have generally been attracted to more lucrative careers either because they need to support a family or simply because that's what they valued. The job market has changed faster than those cultural expectations, which is why men seek out more typically prestigious jobs. This current gap is a reflection of that reality. Safe, stable jobs like nursing are doing really well in a bad time thanks to an aging population, while we are on the tail end of trendy jobs that would have made a lot of money in a better environment. This also explains why unemployment amongst non-college educated men has been pretty stable, because construction, the trades, and other semi-skilled jobs have been pretty stable between increased home construction and infrastructure. You can also see the beating they took after construction slowdowns from the global financial crisis, which were not nearly as bad for their college educated peers. Now, these differences hurt women in the workforce too. When women do go into these trendy fields like technology, they actually tend to do worse when it comes to downsizing. A study on the recent round of tech layoffs sweeping the industry found that women accounted for 44% of job losses while only representing 28% of the workforce. Now, the companies obviously didn't release comprehensive data on why they chose to lay off who, but generally there are three explanations for this. The first is that these companies may have hired evenly, but they still segregated genders within different departments, hiring more women for jobs in HR, marketing, corporate culture, and internal development. These are, coincidentally, the first departments to get cut in downsizing. The second explanation is that in some ways, cultural expectations work for men. They are seen as a breadwinner supporting a family, where the hashtag girl boss is more likely to land on their feet. This is another example of something that employers should clearly not be doing, but women are consistently judged more harshly in high-performing roles compared to men. Unfortunately, this often happens particularly from other women, who disproportionately work in departments like HR, which can have a lot of sway over layoff decisions. The third crude explanation is that hiring practices that targeted a diversity objective over just hiring the best person for the job favored people who would underperform compared to their peers. So when performance-based layoffs were conducted, these people were more likely to be below the cutoff. It's no secret that a lot of the cultural forward companies have pulled a hard 180 on a lot of these initiatives in the last year. Now, I am sure you can probably tell, but I am trying to be really careful about sidestepping the whole culture war rabbit hole here. But it's still important to acknowledge these realities when looking at these issues, because even though it shouldn't, it will have a big impact on everybody's career. One of the best things to do with this information is to use it to your advantage. Despite the stigma, one of the safest groups from trouble in the job market are men in previously female-dominated fields. Fields like healthcare already have a low unemployment rate, and men often find it particularly easy to get these roles because of the practical realities that they can more easily do a lot of the physical work these roles involve. This was dubbed the glass elevator effect all the way back in 1992 in a University of Texas article. It found that men often found it much easier to progress in these roles, and even though initial salaries were lower compared to male-dominated fields, after accounting for the higher chance of career progression, the lifetime earnings shifted back into their favor. Now, obviously, don't pick a job because of some video on the internet. Healthcare and teaching are no joke, but also don't let some business school douchebag talk you out of it, because chances are you will end up earning more than them. Late last month, the paragon of wise economic decisions, Greece, introduced a 6-day, 48-hour work week. The country did this at the same time as its European neighbors have been successfully experimenting with shorter 4-day work weeks. But the Greek government has insisted that this new change is the key to turning its economy around by simply working harder than everybody else. It's a bold strategy, and for the sake of working conditions everywhere, we better hope it doesn't work. Unfortunately, it just might.
Greece has become the first country in the European Union to introduce a 6-day working week for some businesses.
Now, the world's biggest trial of a 4-day working week has ended in success, with the performance of companies largely unharmed and workers feeling healthier and happier.
The employer says, this is it, take it or leave it. You can't do anything about it. This is Greece.
Greece has an aging and shrinking population. According to the country's statistics authority, over 500,000 young, educated citizens left the country to find work with better paying conditions elsewhere. It's very easy for Greek workers to find jobs that pay better in other countries, because as members of the European Union, they are free to reside and work across borders with very few restrictions. In order to correct for this loss of manpower, the government has decided to introduce a 6-day work week to make up for all the workers who have left the country and to support all the elderly people who can no longer support themselves. By raw arithmetic, their logic makes sense. Kind of. Output is the hourly productivity of a worker multiplied by how many hours they work. If Greece has fewer workers, it can increase its output by getting those who are left to work even longer and harder. What they have failed to account for, though, is that a lot of the productive workers still left in the country might decide that they would rather go and work 4 days per week in Belgium for double the average salary than stick it out grinding 6 days a week for half the pay in Greece. If your country has a problem with young people leaving to find better work elsewhere, the solution is probably not to make working conditions even worse. But their new plan argues that by getting on their hashtag grind, they can bring people back by just paying them more. There is also an argument that longer hours tend to be the hallmark of highly compensated professions. C-suite executives, medical practitioners, investment bankers, corporate lawyers, and senior tech workers all regularly put in long hours, and they are all generally well compensated for that time. These professionals are expected to be on call all the time and meet the demands of their clients and patients who simply can't wait. Hospitals have been routinely understaffed and have been relying on staff working longer overtime to keep operations running. These long hours have been linked to unnecessary patient deaths and worker burnout across the country. But doctors and nurses who are willing to stay on call for these odd hours can make an absolute f*** ton of money. Investment banking teams are doing much less important work than medical professionals, and they spread their teams even more thin so that fees on transactions only need to be spread between a few overworked team members. In my own personal investment banking experience, even on very large deals, we never had a team larger than 5 people because managing directors knew that the analysts and associates had to grind it out anyway. And why would they share their bonus with more headcount? If Greece can become the place where people work harder, they should attract these kinds of high-paying jobs, right? Well, not really. Greece already has high unemployment, and anybody who could work in these roles has likely already left to somewhere like London, Frankfurt, or come here to America. For most jobs, there is absolutely no need to be in the office 6 days a week. If you work in an office, you know that you have a set of tasks to do, and once they are done, your new task becomes looking busy for the rest of the week. But that's exactly the point. This law isn't really targeting office jobs. In fact, most of them are explicitly excluded from this law. Instead of magically creating high-paying jobs like promised, what this new law is really about is squeezing the most out of workers on the other end of the pay scale. Retail, transport, construction, and hospitality are jobs where companies just need someone behind a counter or on the tools for as many hours of operation as possible to serve customers periodically. A large share of what's left of the Greek workforce are in these types of roles, and businesses are already demanding a lot of extra hours from their employees. Greece may have a reputation for a laid-back lifestyle and 3 p.m. siestas. But according to data from the OECD, the average Greek actually works a full 80 hours per year more than the average American, and we are already way above average. The average German, on the other hand, works 500 fewer hours every year, and they are still more than twice as productive as workers in Greece. High unemployment has meant that employers can ask a lot from their employees because finding another job is extremely hard, and replacing a worker that isn't willing to work some unpaid overtime is extremely easy. This new 6-day work week is really being sold as a way to formalize what's been going on in workplaces across the country already. To make matters worse, the wording of the law makes it all sound very optional. DW reports that while the 40-hour work week is still officially in place, employers are permitted to require staff to work up to 2 unpaid hours per day for a limited period in return for more free time. The problem is that if businesses have the option to ask their staff to work 2 hours of unpaid overtime every day, and those staff can't say no, then that's just going to be the new normal. In the same article, an emeritus professor of labor law is quoted as saying, "Law 5053-2023 will kill off the 5-day work week for good, so it's probably not as optional as politicians would like workers to believe. Some people may leave, but most of those who can already have." Better opportunities exist in other EU countries, but a lot of Greeks don't have the resources to move their families across Europe to compete for a job against a local in a country like Germany. This is about squeezing what is left from who is left. Look, I normally try my absolute best to form a rounded argument that represents both sides when addressing stories like this, but this 6-day work week is just f***ing dumb. It won't make workers work harder. It won't create high-paying jobs. It won't improve productivity. It will drive away what few young workers the country has left. It will lower hourly wages and create terrible working conditions for the whole country. It's all around terrible policy. But unfortunately, it's not just Greece doing this. It's easy and sometimes even fun to laugh at dumb decisions made by out-of-touch politicians, but the Greek problem is not just a problem in Greece. Greece is a very expensive country to live in, because it's so popular with wealthy tourists who make their money elsewhere. But the minimum wage is only 830 euros per month, according to wageindicator.org. That means the average Greek needs the extra work anyway, whether it's legally mandated or not. But let me make a big, bold claim here. Wages haven't kept up with living expenses anymore. Crazy, I know. But the way we are dealing with it is kind of strange. The good news is that the average employee almost everywhere is working fewer hours than we used to in previous generations. According to data from the OECD, annual hours worked per worker have declined significantly since the 1950s. But you would be forgiven for thinking that it doesn't really feel like that. And you would be kind of right. The amount of time workers are spending at work has gone down, but the total number of people has gone up a lot too. Put it simply, what this means is that even though the average individual worker is spending less time on the job, the average household is spending more time working, because it's now much less likely that a woman in the household is a stay-at-home parent. Now, women having the ability to enter the workforce in a meaningful way has been positive progress, but it's also now become a necessity. Having a stay-at-home partner, man or woman, is an unaffordable luxury for most households in America, especially younger workers. This means the average household is dedicating time to more work, and household chores are not taken care of by a single person while another person focuses on work. So while these numbers might look like we are moving in the right direction, the reality is a little bit more complicated. You might have also noticed that the number of people in the workforce is actually going down. But that's largely because as a larger share of our population gets older, some of them can retire while still of working age. This was accelerated by a huge drop at the start of the pandemic when a lot of people who were almost ready to retire were laid off and just never went back to work. This is also great. People should be able to retire and enjoy their twilight years. But with an aging population, this also put more pressure on younger people to pick up the slack. What this means is that there is a bit of a disconnect between what these charts show and what the average worker will experience. According to a study conducted by ADP Research, the average American worker is now doing 9.2 hours of unpaid and often unreported overtime. That is a number suspiciously close to the extra hours that are going to be demanded of Greek workers. The only difference is, they were dumb enough to say it out loud. That also doesn't account for the growing number of people working in a full-time role and then doing informal gig work or freelancing on the side. The number of new businesses created in America has exploded in recent years, and while this is normally a sign of a healthy, prospering economy, there might be a little bit more to this data. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, 5.5 million new business applications were filed with them in 2023, an all-time high. But suspiciously, these new business applications were coming from the states with the worst employment problems. People are not really starting businesses anymore because they have a great idea and want to capitalize on it. They are starting them to formalize income from informal work like Fiverr, Uber, and yes, even YouTube. According to a Bankrate survey, more than 1 in 3 Americans now have a side hustle on top of their full-time job. And more than 30% of respondents said they expected to need the extra income their side hustle brings in for the rest of their lives. The number of people doing a side hustle jumps to almost 50% amongst Gen Zers and is obviously significantly lower amongst baby boomers who either just have one job or are retired. Picking up a side hustle in addition to your full-time job can be an amazing way to start a business while maintaining the safety of a stable-ish income. I did it while starting this channel. And Richard from The Plain Bagel made an amazing video recently about why he still works his full-time job instead of just focusing on his almost 1 million subscriber YouTube channel. The key difference here is that it was a choice, rather than a necessity. Mr. Bagel is probably doing well for himself with his YouTube channel, but that's not your typical side hustle. Ted Rossman, the credit analyst that ran the survey, said that while it's admirable that so many Americans are putting in extra time and effort into their side hustles, it's unfortunate that most are doing so simply to fund their expenses. This is especially troubling since if side hustles are just a way to increase income as opposed to building up a business or monetizing a hobby, then they are mostly a pretty terrible waste of time. Most people with a side hustle who were surveyed were effectively just working another job that paid well below the minimum wage. So, while it looks like the amount of time you spend working has gone down, and you might even be lucky enough to live in a place experimenting with a 4-day work week, we haven't filled that extra time with leisure or just getting a good night's sleep. We have split domestic work, taken on second jobs and side hustles, and just stuck around answering Slack messages off the clock. A lot of us are working 6 days a week. Greece was just the only one to admit it. It's a classic gripe of out-of-touch corporate executives hiring minimum wage workers or the trust fund baby who is angry that their gym is busy in the middle of the day. Nobody wants to work anymore. Now, I really hate to say this, but by looking at the numbers, they might have a point. Labor force participation is approaching generational lows even after the pandemic, while labor force participation amongst men specifically is the lowest it has ever been. These declines have been happening at the same time that unemployment is theoretically quite low, which, if the economists are to be believed, means it should be easy for people who want to get a job to get a job, right? Well, not quite. And these numbers are confusing at best, or downright misleading at worst.
Is people just don't want to go to work.
There was a poll I read a long time ago. Only like 18% of Americans feel engaged when they're at work.
I hate my job!
The signs are everywhere. Businesses, especially restaurants, need employees and they need them
now.
Dude,
less than 20% of the country likes their f***ing job.
Okay, so there are two general schools that people fall into when they see that nobody wants to work anymore. The first group are wealthy executives, business owners, or just people who have always worked incredibly hard who don't like that jobs are going unfilled. So they blame it on lazy young people who would rather sit around all day smoking cones and watching skibbity toilets. The second school of thought agrees that yes, people don't want to work. They don't want to work demeaning jobs where they won't get paid enough to support a decent quality of life. It's nice when two groups who are so different can agree on something. So really, the only thing left is to work out why people don't want to work. Now, in most cases, the jobs that nobody wants to work fall into one of three categories. The first are jobs that are just paying well below market rates given the experience or the location required. Businesses aren't going to be able to fill a full-stack senior development role in Silicon Valley for $50,000 a year plus equity in their questionable pre-seed startup, but there are still plenty that try. Even entry-level jobs that pay minimum wage in very high cost of living areas are going to be much harder to fill in a city where even finance bros are living in shared housing. Now, hot take alert, but just like there are no shortage of crappy businesses and managers that expect to pay workers nothing for world-class skills and experience, there are lots of workers who expect world-class pay with little or no marketable expertise. One of the most insightful pieces of data on this issue is this recent survey right here. It asked a selection of Americans what they considered to be the minimum salary they would need to be financially successful. Now, most of the responses to these numbers have been laughing at the Gen Zs just entering the workforce who think that almost $600,000 a year is a realistic salary goal. Because for most people, it just isn't. Unless you are in a few very specific career paths, there are basically no jobs that pay this money. And even then, you need an insane amount of luck to get those opportunities. Now, you can blame this on young people who don't really know how the world works yet, or social media that makes it look like every hustle bro is flying private, but it's all distracting from a more interesting data point. The average boomer thinks financial success is achieved with a salary of just under $100,000. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, this is still almost double the median national salary. But in most major cities where people can actually find jobs that pay this much, $100,000 certainly doesn't afford a lifestyle of financial success. There is simply a massive gap in expectations between the generations looking for their first jobs and the group responsible for giving out most of the jobs, so they both agree that nobody wants to work, just for different reasons. The second type of job that nobody wants to work are in workplaces that push their staff, demand unreasonable overtime, or have management that are needlessly abusive. This happens in a shocking amount of businesses across the country. And even if you are lucky enough to avoid a boss that thinks shouting is an effective motivation tool, you have probably worked some overtime out of fear of losing your job or being reprimanded. According to a 2023 workplace survey, the average full-time worker across the country studied is now putting in an average of 9.2 hours of unpaid overtime. These jobs often don't have much trouble finding people to start, but they do struggle with high staff turnover. The third are simply jobs that never actually existed. You probably all know about ghost jobs by now, but even if you really do want to work, there is a good chance that most of your applications are just going to build out a workforce database, not to actually be considered for employment. Now, whatever the specific reason, the results are the same. Less people end up working. But aside from settling some beef between entitled Zoomers and some out-of-touch boomers, this data all reveals something more concerning about work in the current economy. It's not that people don't want to work anymore. They simply can't afford to. Okay, so yeah, There are millions of people out there that think nobody wants to work because they couldn't hire someone with 20 years of experience on a programming language that has only been out for 5 years for $15 an hour. There are also people who don't want to work because they think unless they are offered six figures in their first role out of high school, it's not worth their time, and they would be better off sitting at home working on their NFT dropshipping business. Both of these groups definitely exist in shockingly large numbers. But even though it's really fun to make fun of both sides, it distracts from the much more important reason why labor force participation is getting worse. Well, as you might have been able to guess, this trend is really being driven by specific age groups and specific locations. If you look at labor force participation and exclude the youngest generation of workers and the oldest generation of workers, it's actually approaching all-time highs, which really makes sense when you think about it. It's common for both men and women to work full-time these days, and for most households, it's simply a financial necessity. So yeah, even if people don't want to work anymore, they kind of are stuck doing it anyway. The reason labor force participation has fallen off in general, though, is because the average is being dragged down by a lot of young workers and old workers. The old workers are the easiest to explain. As people started living longer, retirement ages were pushed back, and more of the population began working in non-physical jobs. As a result, a larger share of the population over 55 remained in the workforce. This has started to reverse, though, as self-funded retirement systems and general asset prices have allowed a lot of over 55s to step back from the labor force, especially after COVID, as a lot of people received severance packages and decided that an early retirement was better than going back to the office. Labor force participation from young people just entering the workforce either out of high school or college is also pulling down the average, just for different reasons. More people than ever are getting a college degree, which means they are starting to work later, and fewer people are working part-time jobs while they study because for many, it's simply not worth it given how much debt they are going to be in when they graduate anyway. This might not also be a shock to you, but it's getting really damn hard to find a job out of college. A few months ago, a post from a professor at Berkeley made the rounds after it spoke about his top students from a top college struggling to find work in technology, an industry that was hiring highly intelligent graduates like this as fast as they could make them just 24 months ago. Previously, a Berkeley CS graduate, even if not a top student, would receive multiple appealing job offers in terms of work type, location, salary, and employer. However, outstanding students, like those with a 4.0 in-major GPA, are now contacting me worried because they have zero offers. I suspect this trend is irreversible and likely part of the broader trend impacting almost every employment sector. It's pretty grim stuff coming out of one of the best schools in the country. It might not be the most logical thing to do, but a common reaction from people who can't land a job with a degree they got to make them more employable is to just go get another degree. The rate of master's and PhD recipients has grown even faster than people getting an undergraduate degree, because that's now normal to stand out in a highly competitive job market. And to be honest, it's a nice way for people to avoid the reality of the job market for another few years. Spending another 2 to 8 years at college to get advanced degrees means people aren't in the labor force, which pulls down the average to look worse than it really is. So those are the ages that are perpetuating this dumb myth. But this trend is also highly dependent on location. And to see that, you need to go to the place where apparently the absolute least amount of people want to work. Yes, the Rust Belt state has the lowest labor force participation in the country, but also some of the most unusual statistical anomalies. The state is quite poor after its major industries like coal mining and manufacturing were either outsourced or simply fell out of widespread use. This means that a lot of areas have effectively been left behind with no major employment opportunities, meaning that labor force participation is much lower than the national average. But strangely, in some areas, the participation rate is much higher than what would be expected. A recent study conducted by economists from Hamline University, Cornell, and Virginia Tech found that depending on the county, labor force participation in West Virginia ranges from 42% to 77%, a gap between regions of 35%, while the average across the US states is just 17%, less than half of West Virginia. It's not unusual that cities and working towns will have higher labor force participation than other areas, because people often specifically move to these locations just to get work. But this variance was startling and uncovered a bigger national trend. The people in areas that still had work can't afford not to work, and the people in areas with no work couldn't afford to move to areas with work since it could mean giving up family support networks or simply paying for the cost to relocate housing. A lot of people who had the financial means have already moved out of the state, only making this problem worse, as they take business opportunities and money away with them. It's a dense read because it's an academic paper. It's for nerds. But if you ever feel compelled to say that nobody wants to work anymore, I definitely suggest you have a look at it. The report itself also looks at welfare issues specific to West Virginia. But just because the state is experiencing this problem the worst doesn't mean that it's in any way just something hurting them. The trend of a few concentrated cities doing extremely well while everywhere else stagnates can make nationwide figures look good. But it also means people who want to work have an option of trying their luck for one of the few jobs left in areas with fewer opportunities, or living in an extremely expensive city to compete with everybody else fighting over a spot in the few places left where people can reliably get ahead. There are 8.2 million job openings in America right now, and around 7 million people actively looking for a job. There are also millions of Americans who have simply given up on even trying to look for a job. But still, companies are complaining that they can't get the people they need. There is one reason that has been used time and time again to explain all of this.
A range of companies are looking at how to close the skills gap.
Yep, the skills gap. There are people looking for work and jobs on offer, but the skills of those people and the requirements of the jobs just don't line up. It's a simple, elegant explanation to a major problem, but it's also almost entirely made up.
20-year-old Jesus Villegas is in the second year of his training. He's building a career in advanced construction technology.
Today's incomes gap is largely a skills gap.
87% of Americans said that they are going to need to get skills and new training throughout their work life. It's really remarkable.
The skills gap, also known as the skills shortage, or just good old structural unemployment, is a convenient excuse for a lot of major issues in today's job market that are often swept under the rug by businesses, politicians, and even economic statistics. If a hospital is hiring a doctor, but the only person in town looking for a job has a degree in computer science, then obviously that role is not going to be filled regardless of how much time and effort the applicant has put into their education. The argument that you would have seen is that this same problem is playing out everywhere across the world, which is why even if companies claim to be desperate to hire people, you might struggle to find a job. The whole argument conveniently shifts the blame of any labor market problems onto the workers because they are the ones that haven't trained the right skills or developed the right experience. The first problem with this idea, though, is how the problem of the skills gap quietly slips away during the good times. Research published by economists from Harvard, Northern University, and the Federal Reserve found a striking relationship between unemployment and the experience that employers look for in their candidates. The team collected data on over 36 million job postings over 3 years, and what they found was that the skills and experience required was almost directly proportional to the unemployment rate. In plain English, what this meant was that when there were lots of people looking for a job, all of a sudden the skills requirement for roles became a lot higher. And this is when people will start complaining about a skills gap. But when unemployment is lower, and there aren't that many people applying for jobs, suddenly the skills gap isn't such a big problem, and companies are happy to hire whoever they can get. Now, as long as they aren't discriminating based on protected classes, companies can basically hire whoever they want and ask for whatever skills they can. If unemployment is high and they can be greedy with their job requirements, that's just business. But the problem is, the myth of the skills gap is used to justify a lot of bad stuff. The first is simply lower wages. If companies post a position with high skill requirements and they don't get any applicants that meet their unreasonably high bar, they can go back to the best applicant with a lower salary and benefit offer than advertised, pointing out the gaps in their skills as a reason for the lower offer. This is just basic salary negotiation tactics, but the myth of the skills gap makes it easier for companies to get away with this. A report by MIT found that most jobs advertised in America ask for skills like programming that were actually not required to perform the job. They looked specifically at IT help desk technicians that deal with computers, so most companies ask for programming skills. The thing is, though, most IT help desk techs don't actually use programming for anything. But a lot of companies just assume that computers equal code, and so make it a job requirement. The report actually found that programming was just as useful in manufacturing plants as it was in IT help desk work. But factory machine operators were far more likely to get on-the-job training on how to program their machines than IT workers who were just assumed to know how to code. But lower wages are far from the worst thing that the myth of the skills gap has been used to push for. It's also been an incredible tool for lobbying on migration policy, education funding, and workplace protections. These are worth looking at one by one, because you are probably going to start hearing a lot of familiar sound bites. If there was actually a supply of good-paying jobs available to people that were going unfilled because of the skills gap, then the traditional market assumption would be that people would retrain to fill those roles to increase their income and job security. But that isn't happening because there are problems with every part of this assumption. The first problem is that a lot of the jobs we have a skills gap for here in America don't actually pay that well. According to a report by the Society of Resource Management, the hardest roles to fill currently include jobs like nursing, teaching, the trades, and social service work. Most jobs in these roles do not pay enough to support a comfortable life in a major city, especially for entry-level employees into the roles. The trades can be great, but apprentice tradesmen are not going to earn much until they are fully qualified, and even then, they need to work significant overtime or own their own business to make a comfortable salary in most parts of the country. Even still, they are going to be better off than teachers and nurses who not only need a college degree where they won't be paid anything, they also need on-the-job training before they are earning anything at all. That's on top of reports about extreme job stress, brutal work schedules, and the general lack of respect these roles receive. Putting your career on hold, spending tens of thousands of dollars on a college degree, and dealing with difficult patients or often dangerous patients or children is not that enticing to Americans who would consider a career switch because the income for these roles hasn't risen in line with the demand gap. There is not a skills shortage. There is just a shortage of people who want to do difficult jobs for bad pay. People in these roles who already have the skills to perform the job at a high level are leaving because it's just not worth making the sacrifices necessary when there are easier jobs that pay just as much or more. A counterexample to this trend was the rush to train computer science. The tech industry in the 2000s was expanding rapidly, and we didn't have enough coders to perform roles that actually needed programming skills. The allure of high-paying, respected jobs with a good work-life balance meant a lot of very smart people moved into that career path to fill the skills gap because there was a real reward for doing so. Now, there are actually too many qualified programmers, and as the tech industry has cooled down, hundreds of thousands of people have been laid off. Just 5 years ago, though, they would have been told that there isn't enough programmers, and companies are hiring whoever they can as fast as they can. So, the assumption that empty jobs are just waiting to be filled and the only thing standing in the way is the skills gap can be a bit dangerous. But the final piece of the puzzle is how profitable fixing this myth can be. Politicians can win some easy political points by talking about retraining programs, and companies can push the responsibility of staff training onto their workers or those government programs. The market research firm Allied Market Research values the corporate training market at over $361 billion, with it projected to grow to over $800 billion by 2035. That's a major industry just by itself, and it relies heavily on people believing that they are just one qualification away from landing a job that is just desperate to find the right worker. This industry is separate from traditional colleges and trade schools, but you already know what a mess that whole thing is. The skills gap has been a major lobbying tool by companies to push for this kind of training. Siemens, an industrial equipment manufacturer, paid for an article in The Atlantic talking directly to policymakers that the apprenticeships were the secret to closing the skills gap. Apprenticeships are actually great, but the reason that Siemens was paying to publish this article is that it would give them a new pool of skilled workers to pick from, not because they wanted to help out with labor force policies. And this is where you get to the most controversial part of the skills gap. It's used to justify immigration. Now, this is obviously a heated topic that everybody has their own set of opinions on, but it is possible to advocate for more careful and deliberate immigration policies without going full, "they took our jobs." The skills gap has been used to push for a lot of skilled migration, which has arguably gone too far in America, but it's been even more obvious in places like Canada, the UK, Australia, Germany, and New Zealand. The reason companies like this is because it lets them fill roles without putting upward pressure on salaries, and more people means more customers to sell products to. If the skills gap is front and center around these sensitive issues, it makes it easier for policy to be hand-waved through as an essential measure to keep the country functioning. Here in America, H-1B and EB-3 skilled working visas are the most common way to get in workers who fill skilled roles that can't be filled by an American. They come with a strict set of rules to make sure that American workers are not disadvantaged by new foreign hires. But if job requirements are kept unreasonably high to make an artificial skills gap, it becomes easier to hire workers from overseas who will be dependent on that company's sponsorship to stay in America. Who do you think is more likely to be a loyal employee? The average public CEO now makes nearly 400 times more than the average American, as their pay has increased by an average of 1,460% since 1978. Now, you probably already know the old joke that, no, they are not working 400 times harder than their employees. But being a CEO is still a serious commitment that normally involves making lifelong sacrifices to climb the corporate ladder or start a successful business, all while being constantly accountable to shareholders and a board of directors. The pay is good, but the work is hard. And if you want to be a CEO, you need to be on call 24/7 to put out fires, or your time at the top will be very short-lived. That's the story, anyway. So then, what the f*** is behind the massive rise in CEOs that only work part-time, if they show up to work at all?
Maximum damage reduction. This person saying.
Fired this morning after the company offered a private jet to its new CEO. Instead of relocating to Starbucks headquarters in Seattle, incoming CEO Brian Nicole will be commuting from his home in Newport Beach, California.
I never wanted to be an engineer. I never wanted to be a programmer. I never wanted to start a company. I had an idea and I wanted to build it. And I did whatever it took to build it.
Elon Musk is a controversial figure. But love him or hate him, the one thing that nobody has been able to take away from him is that he works incredibly hard. That was until recently, when people started to notice that the man has been playing an awful lot of Diablo 4. According to other players, he would have had to spend as much as 17 hours a day playing the game to reach the levels he has shown off in various live streams. Now, it is possible the world's richest man could have paid someone else to play video games for him. But a potential Diablo addiction aside, it did raise questions about how any mortal man could possibly be an effective chief executive at SpaceX and Tesla when he also has a full-time role at four other major companies. Even seasoned executives have to dedicate enormous amounts of their time to running just one company. The reality is that Elon Musk is far from the worst offender of a major company CEO showing up to their job less than you do. Brian Nicole is the newly appointed CEO of Starbucks. To join the company, he was offered a sign-on bonus which could be worth as much as $113 million within his first year. Now, some of that bonus was to compensate him for the stock options he will be giving up by leaving his previous job as the CEO of Chipotle. But it's still a record-breaking package, which is especially generous when you consider that the man won't even be moving to the same state as his new company's HQ. He will instead be permitted to work remotely from his current home in Newport Beach, and will be allowed to commute using the company's private jet when he has to be in the office. Oh yeah, and in case you were wondering, yes, Starbucks and its remote CEO did introduce a return-to-office mandate for all of its lesser office staff. Jack Dorsey, the former CEO of Twitter, rarely showed up to the company's offices, allegedly spending most of his time at his other company, Block. Just last month, it was announced that the new CEO of Victoria's Secret would also be allowed to work remotely so that they didn't have to move to the company's HQ in Columbus, Ohio. And yes, Victoria's Secret has also made it mandatory for everybody else to work from the office. There are tens of thousands of highly qualified candidates that would kill to be the CEO of one of these companies, so the hiring board can be picky with who they choose to hire. So then, why the f*** are these top employees allowed to work from home and dedicate their time to a second or third job when doing the same thing would get anybody else fired? Well, there are actually three reasons, and they are each more disappointing than the last. The first is that CEOs have become little more than a cheerleader for their company. Brian Nichols' offer to join Starbucks may sound obscene, but to the board of directors and current shareholders, it's so far actually been a pretty prudent investment. Since its announcement, the company's value has shot up by over $20 billion on the news, which means investors just see that his astronomical pay package has covered itself 20 times over. The new investors buying in also know that no matter how brilliant Nicole might be as a chief executive, he is not single-handedly going to be able to turn the company around or individually going to add $20 billion in valuation by himself. The actual reason why so many new investors bought in upon the announcement of the new CEO was because of what he represents. Nicole, in particular, has built a reputation of being an absolute hardass against unionization efforts and someone who is quite good at reinvigorating brand image. The new CEO is obviously a master at public relations as well, because if you Google his name and union, the only thing you will find is an identical article from about 20 different outlets all reporting on his announcement that he was willing to engage with workers. Whatever that means. But for investors, declining brand appeal and the union efforts are the issues facing the company. So appointing someone to do the job who has become infamous for fixing these issues is a display that the company is taking these issues seriously. A better example might be someone like Musk. He now has as much or more brand presence as the companies that he leads. A lot of his business's actual success may have very well been achieved by the engineers and level-headed executives working behind the scenes. but he is at least partially responsible for employing those people in the first place, so now he has a reputation as a serial entrepreneur that builds the businesses of the future. A very appealing pitch to investors. Even old Dorsey of Twitter, who apparently hated his job as CEO, presented an image that aligned with the company's investment pitch as an alternative communications channel that, like, democratizes information, man. This is all a relatively new phenomenon. Even 20 years ago, people didn't know big company CEOs unless they were extremely high-profile founders. Do you know who the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, Eli Lilly, or ExxonMobil is? Unless you are an industry insider or highly informed investor, probably not. But thanks to social media, new marketing techniques, and a new cultural interest in business and finance, CEOs, especially CEOs of modern consumer-facing companies, are just as much influencers for their businesses as they are someone performing executive functions day-to-day. Do you know who the CEOs of Apple, Berkshire Hathaway, Facebook, NVIDIA, or Tesla is? Even if you don't care about business that much, you probably do. And that's because these men have become just as important to these companies' marketing strategy as celebrity endorsements and advertising campaigns. Now, some of these men still work incredibly hard in addition to being a spokesperson for their company. But for some of them, it's become possible to offload the boring work onto other employees and spend the rest of their time elsewhere. And for a lot of companies, that may very well be for the best. The role of the CEO has changed so much that even an otherwise competent business leader like Mark Zuckerberg has had to rethink his image as a technically proficient lizard person into something at least resembling a human. Now, it's possible that he is having a midlife crisis, but as several outlets have pointed out, it's probably much more likely that someone in his company has told him that human beings like human beings, so his business would probably be doing a lot better if he played the part. Now, getting CEOs out of the office and into the public eye as a branding tool might win over some users, investors, and potentially even some regulators, but unsurprisingly, there is one group that isn't as easy to win over. A survey conducted by the research firm International Workplace Group found that 93% of the 500 CEOs surveyed don't go into the office full-time, and instead have adopted a hybrid or exclusively work-from-home arrangement. That's compared to 64% of workers who make less than $38,000 a year who are expected to be in the office full-time. Now, this study was conducted in the UK, and there is no concrete numbers like this that could be found in America. But unfortunately, the attitudes are very similar on both sides of the pond. Unsurprisingly, this has caused a bit of a morale problem, because people are being told to go back into the office or start filing for unemployment while simultaneously watching the very public antics of their CEO. Even if they are going on podcasts, building custom Porsche minivans, traveling to remote seminars, or putting in hours at a completely different business exclusively for the good of their company's brand image, it can be hard for someone filling out TPS reports to accept the hypocrisy that they have to be in their office. Now, according to the survey, company CEOs are aware of this frustration. They just don't care. It's no secret that return-to-work mandates have been used by companies as a sneaky way to do layoffs, without having to actually publicly announce layoffs which could impact their stock price. Unfortunately for them, that's not really working, as people have seen the news and are trying to hold on to their jobs even if it means going back into the office. From a business management point of view, this can also be fine-tuned to other staff as well. High-performing staff on uncompetitive salaries can be given the option to work from home, where average or below average staff or employees that were hired with higher wages can be told the office is mandatory for them. Just this week, KPMG announced official layoffs, and they weren't even hiding it anymore when they admitted it was because not enough people were voluntarily resigning. To an absent CEO, staff being frustrated at the clear double standards is a feature and not a bug. Of course, another reason that CEOs can get away with not showing up to work is that they are only answerable to the board of directors, and if the company is doing well, most boards simply don't care. In a lot of companies, the boards are packed with people friendly to the CEO, so unless they really f*** up, they are free to offload whatever work they want. Nobody wants to be responsible for a big change for no reason. And that's probably the biggest reason why absentee CEOs have become so popular so quickly. According to data from Standard & Poor's, outside of the lead-up to the dot-com bubble in 2001, the world's biggest companies are now on average younger than they have ever been. A large share of the world's largest businesses, especially in America, were only founded a few decades ago. A huge venture capital financing has made scaling certain companies faster than ever, but that means that most of the time, the businesses get to where they are with their founders still in a leadership position. The problem is that being the founder of a rapidly scaling startup and being the CEO of a large company are two completely different jobs. Having the skills and experience to do either job is rare. Having the skills to do both is almost unheard of. The problem is that most founders want to maintain control of their company for as long as possible, even if there would be more qualified people to run it once it reaches a certain scale. In my own experience working on mergers and acquisitions deals, one of the biggest sticking points would be the role of the founders if their company was acquired, or once they lose majority control of the company in financing rounds. Getting rid of a CEO founder is difficult and often unpopular. So instead, investors, and often the founders themselves, will appoint people to do the managerial work, while they just stick around as the face of the company as the CEO in name only. There is nothing necessarily wrong with this, although having a company linked to the personal image of its founders can be risky, especially if they aren't in the office where an eye can be kept on them. Now, the more controversial bonus reason is that the role of a CEO is slowly becoming extinct with new corporate practices. I'm going to be writing a piece this week on the fading relevance of the typical CEO in some companies on my completely free email newsletter linked in the video description. You can also watch this video about why another group of CEOs are being asked to kindly but firmly retire now or else, to keep on learning how money works.